Welcome to the Live Up podcast, where we revisit the movies from our youth to see if they live up. We will review, discuss, and score whether the movie in question lives up to us now as adults and whether it lives up to the intended audience today. I'm Jess Latterman.
And I'm Amanda Treat. On today's episode, we're reviewing a film that examines the inconvenient truth of an oil-dependent society devolving into an apocalyptic wasteland, while one independent frontier town leads the transition to renewable energy. Also, you can hear Jess laughing because they have a Thunderdome.
They do.
Two men enter, one man leaves. It's 1985's Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome.
Jess? That was like by far the most intense introduction I think you've ever given a movie.
Because it's the Thunderdome.
It's the two men enter, one man leaves.
Mad Max. It's got a vibe. So, Jess.
Vibe is a word.
Jess, you reluctantly got dragged into watching this for the first time. You've never seen any of the original Mad Max movies, to my knowledge.
Nope. This is my first.
If you had to describe this movie in one word, what would it be?
This was not hard for me to think about. The word is sweaty.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, yeah, I see that. There's a lot of like heat and leathery outfits and probably a lot of flies. I don't know.
There's a lot of sweat. I felt like I needed a shower.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is my first viewing. It was very sweaty. I have seen the Charlize Theron one, the recent one, but I've never seen the originals with Mel Gibson. I guess like I knew I was in for a wild ride when the opening credits have characters like Iron Bar and Pig Killer. And I'm like, what is this? Amanda.
Great characters.
Yeah. So I definitely texted you a bunch and I was like, so have you changed your mind about this movie?
Just wanted out of this so badly. I swear to God, like our text thread was just like, what the hell is this
movie? Well, I just was like so unsure, but I think that's the beauty of this. We like to revisit things that are from our youth and everybody loves, and we have to see if we should still love them. So tell me why you picked this, Amanda.
Oh my God. So I go way back with Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, but what happened was recently I was in an elevator with my very millennial coworkers and our very Gen Z interns.
But we love our millennial and Gen Z listeners, however.
We love everybody who listens to this podcast, and we're not knocking them. But I was in this elevator with my colleagues, and I saw the headline pop up that Tina Turner had passed away. And I said out loud, oh no, Tina Turner died. And one of my millennial coworkers was like, I don't know who that is. And then another one of them.
I don't believe you. That's
another
insane.
One of them was like, I think she's like a singer. Did she have like a big song or something? And like no idea. And then like because our interns who are, you know, 20, they were just being very polite because they're very happy to be interns and working with us, and like we're just kind of nodding, but like had no idea who I was talking about. So nobody knew who Tina Turner was. And that just hit me right like in the soul, honestly. Like, oh my God, they didn't know how awesome Tina Turner was. And that instantly,
we're going to do something about it, Amanda.
We had just recorded our previous podcast and it was my turn to pick a movie. And I was kind of waffling, honestly. But yeah, it just hit me like, oh my God.
Did it hit you like a thunderbolt?
That we needed to do Tina Turner's all-time amazing performance in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, because she is epic as her performance in Auntie in this. And Jess had never seen it. So it was like a no-brainer that we had to review this movie.
But before we get to that, so what is your history with it though as a kid?
So obviously you and I were way too young to watch this in the theater when it came out, because I think this was it was 1985. So yeah, this is not for us as children, but it's the lightest of the Mad Max movies. Like, this is the funny one, everyone.
Oh God.
It's just like bonkers. And we'll get into all this in a second.
Bonkers is also a word. Yes.
It's just complete craziness going on in this movie. But I don't know when I saw this for the first time. It obviously was on someone's VHS cassette. Somewhere in the, let's say, early 90s, I probably saw it. I don't know how old I was or when I saw it for the first time. But I remember by the time I got to high school that this was a big cult classic reference point, especially with like the athletes. the two men enter, one man leaves thing was huge at my high school. But then I think it was 1996, Tupac and Dr. Dre made that music video for California Love. And the whole thing was Thunderdome all over again. Like they're racing across the desert and they're rapping in the Thunderdome. And it just verified that this was a cultural stamp on our generation. Like you got to see Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. So I have a lot of enthusiasm for it. Doesn't make it a good movie. I don't know. We'll see.
It sounds like you remember it through the veil of it was a cult classic,
yes,
kind of thing,
yeah.
Versus I remember sitting down and watching it all the time.
By the time everyone in high school was shouting about it, I'd probably only seen it once or twice.
Okay. So it was already kind of classic-y by the time.
Yeah. And like rewatching it now, I was just like, oh my God, I totally forgot about this part. There's movies we've reviewed, like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, where I could tell you every line and every scene. And like I had kids watch things over and over. This was not one of those movies. I'm still very excited about it, though. You can tell in my voice, like, woo!
Yeah.
Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome!
I feel like we need to remind listeners here that you and I try not to give each other's opinion away too much before we record, although I think we have a sense. I wasn't like super Debbie Downer about your choice on Thunderdome, but I was a little skeptical after I watched the trailer.
Fair enough. All right, we'll start with the positive preliminary thoughts on Tina Turner, this movie.
I really like that we're starting on this positive note because this movie is nothing without Auntie. She plays the character Auntie. She's kind of a queen, like a literal queen of Bartertown, and she's amazing. I kind of wish she had a musical act inside the Thunderdome. That would have been awesome. But she was definitely epic, definitely iconic. I loved her in this. I know you and I texted about this. She has a great line for her backstory where she's telling Mad Max that I was a nobody. Then I survived. Now I'm somebody. But enough of history. And then like chaos ensues. There's an energy to her that just blows through the screen. She's fantastic.
Oh, I love that line. She's like so smooth.
Such a good line.
And slick about it. But at the same time, like very blasé. Like I was a nobody.
Yeah, it's like she's both like sexy and dangerous. Yeah. She holds your attention so much. Every time she's on screen, it's a better scene, I think.
There's a whole section in the middle where she's not in it, and that's the low point of this movie. You and I were talking before this episode. Normally, we like to do deep dives on characters and let that drive us through the movie, but this movie, all the Mad Max movies, like people don't really talk. You can't really get a deep sense of any of these characters because other than their like leather thongs and stuff, you don't know what's
leather thongs. I can't wait to talk about the leather thongs.
The costumes in all of these movies, the costumes make no sense for the Australian outback. It's like 120 degrees. Is Tina Turner wearing a chainmail dress that weighs 120 pounds allegedly? And is just like jumping into the Thunderdome and driving a car across the outback, like chasing, blah, 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 like that dress weighs 120 pounds. Oh my God, what were they thinking?
I mean, this is just one thing about the movie that doesn't make sense to me, gotta be honest. The costumes are crazy.
Men are dressed like multiple members of the Village People all combined into one. It's like a Village People reunion in every single costume. It's crazy.
It's very odd. There's a lot of leather. There's a lot of bare butts, a lot of mohawks. And a lot of sweat. It definitely reads in the 1980s, I guess. Did they think this is what a gay leather bar looked like? Because I feel like that's the vibe I was getting.
I feel it has its own aesthetic. Gay outback steampunk.
Yeah, I said that to Elena. I was like, I feel like this is like steampunk, but with leather. She was like, my brain doesn't even understand what you're talking about.
So this isn't like a in case you fall off your motorcycle and need to slide kind of vibe. This is just, we're looking cool, but you're not cool because it's 120 degrees and
this is why they're sweaty.
Australian outback.
This is why my one word was sweaty.
Can you imagine like the skin fungus that's going on under some of these outfits?
I can't even imagine how bad even just filming this smelled, but just if you could imagine the world they're creating, the smell must be just unreal.
I mean, wish we had a guest dermatologist to weigh in on this movie just in terms of like
tell us about the amount and the sweating. Oh my God.
There was like hydrocortisone all over this set, like, you know, like, cut, and then all the so extras gross. Have to be rubbed down in hydrocortisone.
Oh my god. That's so gross. Oh, that just added a whole other layer.
It did, but it didn't, because this movie was already pretty like disgusting visually, and like, yeah, we're feeling it viscerally.
Disgusting is also a word. So we've done a lot of movies where we talk about how the plot doesn't matter, but in this case, in a weird way, yeah, some of the characters I feel like didn't really matter. But I am going to just go ahead and try to give a recap of what I think the plot is for those like me who have never seen it, or maybe it just exists for you as some sort of iconic cult classic, but you don't really know that much about it. So here it goes. All right. And I will say, I am still processing this movie. I'm not sure that my brain has really cobbled everything together.
Jess always gives excellent recaps. I'm very excited to hear what she says right now.
You're excited? Okay, here it goes. Set your expectations lower, everybody. All right. So Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, it imagines a post-apocalypse happening inside a hot, dusty leather bar. There's a shortage of water, but for some reason, plenty of hairspray. And a queen battles for supremacy with a man in charge of harnessing energy from pig shit. And I honestly don't know where Mad Max fits in to this description. I like don't understand. And I'm hoping throughout this episode, Amanda's going to make it make sense to me and to you listeners. But yes, this is where we are. We're shouty nonsense inside a leather bar in the apocalypse. That's what this movie is.
I mean, what a great movie though, right? Like, don't you want to go to this bar and just start shouting more nonsense at them? The original movie's honestly set in like present day, which is weird, but they're wearing a lot of leather.
Yeah, because doesn't it take place in 2021? That's maybe what's, like, sort of crazy. And I should but say like, also, we are recording this episode right after each of our respective cities have been shrouded in some sort of wildfire smoke.
We feel this apocalypse slowly creeping towards us.
Pretty much. Like, I mean, I was thinking about it yesterday. We were a code purple, whatever the fuck that means, and code maroon for air quality.
Yeah.
I mean, this almost sounds made up. And I was like, oh my God, it's like sweaty Mad Max. Should I get out my leather assless chaps and just join the apocalypse?
Really, that's how you ride it out. Yeah.
I gotta get more leather for the apocalypse.
I don't have enough of leather for the apocalypse. This is
I don't
really...
either. We're not prepared.
We gotta go shopping.
We gotta get gasoline, water, and leather. Those are your lists.
My understanding of the Mad Max world timeline is that they're having an oil crisis, which actually was happening in the 1970s when the first Mad Max came out. And that it just got worse and worse to the point that countries started nuking each other over resources, and that civilization has just devolved into this fight for the remaining resources. And Mad Max in the first movie has a family, has a job, but loses all of that, goes a little crazy. Now he's Mad Max. And so he just keeps popping into these mini societies in the outback in this post-apocalyptic world. He just kept popping into the worst possible places, saving a few people, and then like going back out into the outback and wandering around. And that's his whole vibe. So like, this is a movie where he's accidentally popping into Barter Town and getting sucked into their world.
So this is a weird thing. And I know there's controversy about Mel Gibson as the actor, but I think I like Mel Gibson as an actor. And I feel like he almost had nothing to do here. Even in my like plot summary, I'm like, where does Mad Max fit in?
Yeah.
It's all this other stuff. It's all this textural stuff. And Mad Max is this iconic character, but he barely speaks.
I agree with you there. Like, I think his character always shows up to observe the crazy. Like, even when it's Tom Hardy, he barely talks.
Yeah. And for those who haven't seen it in a while, Mel Gibson or Mad Max, there's moments where you see him come through in what you kind of expect in a way. I feel like there's sometimes where like I could see the face of Lethal Weapon and all that, but it's few and far between. He's almost just a supporting cast in a way.
Yeah. He's like the straight man in the craziest scenarios.
Like, that's exactly what he's like.
But at the same, somehow he's Mad Max. He does totally go crazy in the first movie, but like he's our eyes and ears on the ground, and he's the normal one in this really screwed up
situation. Because you could totally, this movie could be called Mad Auntie.
Mad Tina Turner.
Mad Tina Turner could be Mad Auntie or Master or fucking pig farm or whatever the hell that shit is. So, I mean, there's madder people. There's crazier people in this than Mad Max.
No, he's our normal tour guide through, like, this weird, crazy place we're going.
And as you're saying, like, we're not going to really deep dive into all the characters. We're just sort of, I think, going to go by section.
Yeah, this movie very distinctly has first act, we're in Bartertown. Second act, we're hanging out with the kids in the ravine. Third act, we're doing a giant chase across the outback and will they live, will they die? But like, it's very sectional. Yeah, and the characters, they're not talking a lot. Or the and people who are talking shouldn't be talking.
When they do talk, I was like, I feel like you just spoke English. That's and I not... understand those individual words, but I'm not sure I understand what it means when it's a full sentence. But so but take us, so take me through the first section. Because I actually, I need your help here. Because even though I've seen it now once, I'm like, what?
No, but like, if this was your first time seeing Mad Max, any Mad Max, or any of the original Mad Maxes, like, we just dropped you into a lot of crazy. Here.
Crazy. We dropped you into the Thunderdome.
And like, first, they don't tell you between these two movies that there's been like a nuclear apocalypse. Then it starts getting referenced a lot in Beyond Thunderdome, but like, there's no explanation that that has happened. So you're just taking it. I mean, this could just be a bad day in Australia for all we know, but like, it's not. You and I both lived in Australia for a little while. Like, this is not actually Australia.
No.
This movie starts with Max in his crazy, it's the vehicle he had in the first two movies, but it doesn't work anymore. So he's having his modified, like, formerly kick-ass car dragged by camels across the outback. There's, like, dust storms, and he's dressed like Lawrence of Arabia, and I am not kidding. I think they're invoking a lot of old movies here, so, like, there's a plane that starts dipping down on him because they ultimately steal his car, even though it's not functional, and leave him stranded in the outback. But it looks like North by Northwest. He's running away from the plane as it dips down on him, and then he pops back up. But he's wrapped up in all of this cloth because he's in 120-degree Cooper Pedy or wherever the hell they're supposed to be.
Yeah, they're in, like, the middle of Australia. It's like...
yeah.
Sweaty and nonsense.
So it starts off like very shaky overhead camera work, but you zoom in on Max. He's in the middle of nowhere. He's got this car. It's being dragged by camels. This plane swoops down and steals it, and they're kind of attacking him. Like, what the hell is going on? So he drags himself without his car over to Bartertown, which is the closest available town. And this is where Jess's head is blowing up. I'm watching her make facial expressions at me as I'm saying this. If you
tell
didn't
me
know
about Bartertown,
what this
Amanda,
was,
I want to hear what you thought of Bartertown when you first watched this as a young person.
I mean, I can't remember my specific memory of it, but here's how it's ingrained in me. This is why we need to fight climate change, people. Because
you do not want to go to Bartertown, people.
I think this is how it ends for all of us if we don't fix climate change. Like, that there's this small town that's run like the wild, wild west in the middle of the Australian outback, and it's still 120 degrees, and people are still running around in their leather thongs, and they're shooting each other in the street, and like, it's just chaos. And the whole thing's being run off of an anaerobic digester because they have a lot of pigs. So, you know what? Small kudos to them for figuring out renewable energy on that scale in the middle of nowhere, but they're still just like letting chaos reign this whole place. There's this opening shot of people filing in to go to work there. And I don't know if anyone else has seen this movie, but that there's that 1960 version of the movie The Time Machine, not the new one with Guy Pearce that we saw. That's not even new anymore. That's like 25 years old. But there's this version we had to see in school because it's based on the book. And like, the way the like waifs are dragging themselves into the dark pit all in a line and just looks so depressing. And they kind of recreate that shot. Mel Gibson as Max gets in the line, like, we got to go into Bartertown. You can't smell things from watching a movie, but you can somehow smell this place.
Oh yeah, because like, everybody's sweaty. Yeah. It runs on pig shit. It is a post-apocalypse hellscape. I mean, this is what we're headed to, people. It sometimes reminded me of how they've depicted settlements in The Walking Dead in a way, when it's like run by a bunch of outlaws. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Total chaos. People are in leather for some reason. I mean, it's a hellscape. It's not the suburban hellscape we talked about in Edward Scissorhands. It is like way fucking worse.
No, this is a literally you're about to get beaten to death hellscape.
Like, oh, it's it's gross. I kept thinking in my head, like the whole Dunkin' Donuts tagline of America runs on Dunkin'. And I'm like, oh, this is a far.
Watertown runs on pigs.
The apocalypse runs on pig shit, everybody.
See, here's where I want to actually give this a positive spin, because I used to work for the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, and I worked for their anaerobic digester program. We were giving out grant money for people to put in
another generators. Way to make shit, I guess. I don't know.
But this movie is actually describing renewable energy. They have propped up a town based on the fact that they can turn feces into methane and run a generator off it and run the whole damn town. And in my head, I was like, nobody's calling that an anaerobic digester, but that's what they're doing here. And like, kudos. They have some solid engineering despite all their leather.
Auntie was able to figure it out with that master guy. I don't know.
Don't let the leather deceive you. These guys have engineering degrees and they have built an anaerobic digester and it runs the whole town. Like, wow, good for them.
Oh. God,
so it doesn't smell good. None of this smells good.
So Auntie, aka Tina Turner, she runs this place, and for some reason, Mad Max is like in the mix.
He shows up and he's like, he's desperate because he's lost his car, he's lost his camels. He shows up in Bartertown, where you have to barter something, or else. Or they'll send you away to die. So he basically barters himself. Like, I can fight. Max kicks some ass and they are impressed and they say, all right, bring him up to Auntie. First of all, her entrance, there's just sexy saxophone playing and shadows.
But it's like weird 80s sexy saxophone.
Oh, it's total 80s sexy saxophone.
It's so cheesy in a way. It was weird. The saxophone to me was weird. Like, the whole score was part sexy saxophone, but like shitty 80s sexy saxophone. So it's like part shitty jazz club, part Roman battle cry, and then part Looney Tunes. Just fucks with your senses, the music.
The actual soundtrack for this is done by Maurice Jarre. He is this Oscar-winning composer. He did Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago. At the same time he's doing this, he's doing movies like Dead Poets Society. He does these like very serious epics. And that is not what this movie is at all. This movie is meant to be chaos. I just felt, even watching that final chase scene, I was thinking about the newest Mad Max movie, and it was like, yeah, the music was keeping me going. Like, it's this heart pounding soundtrack where
it's kind of heavy metal in the new one. And
I mean, they have a guitar player with like flames coming out the guitar in the new one. That's the level of soundtrack we're going for in these car chases. And this soundtrack is too subdued.
It's subdued, but you had like elements of like Looney Tunes or something. It almost had a cartoonish element.
Yeah, it just.
We don't get super nerdy with the music on this podcast, but the music outside of Tina Turner, the actual score to me was distracting because it was so weird.
Yeah. So he shows up, he gets sent to see Auntie Tina Turner. She emerges in her amazing 120-pound chain link
fence.
It's not a chain link fence, although that would have been very revealing. This is also a very revealing dress. Yeah. She shows up in her chainmail dress. Her boobs are popping out. Looks so fucking
badass.
It's like
you're really trying to sell this to me, Amanda.
I'm just trying to sell Tina Turner, honestly. Tina Turner wins this movie.
Yeah, and she's in this power struggle with the guy who runs the pig shit energy operation. And I guess what I gleaned is that she sort of hires Mel Gibson to kill him.
So it's Master Blaster, and it's a...
great name.
It's kind of iconic. It is a smaller engineer who sits atop this giant, but... as they get into the Thunderdome.
By smaller, we mean little person.
Yeah, they basically, Tina Turner's character Auntie wants to take out the larger enforcer side of the operation because she thinks that she can control the guy who is the engineer, who is smaller and can't put up a fight without the bigger guy.
I gotta say, I didn't even understand that. I thought that, I didn't even understand that. I thought that Mel Gibson was supposed to kill both of them.
No,
I was like, what the fuck deal is he making? I don't get it. Then they're in the iconic Thunderdome.
Yeah.
And it's Master versus that big guy, right?
No, like, it's...
No, not Master. Sorry.
It's Blaster. It's the yeah. big guy who never talks. He's just got a helmet on his head and he's huge. And he's just there as the muscle guy. And that's who Auntie Tina Turner wants taken out. Because she feels like she can control the whole town once that guy's out of the picture.
Yeah.
That's the challenge.
That okay, so first of all, didn't even understand that because
this yeah, no, they're just hard. Mumbling their way through the whole thing.
This movie is hard to understand. I mean, there's yeah. so many points where it's like I don't even understand the words coming out of their mouth. And I it struck me that you probably have to watch this movie over and over in order to just kind of go with this fucking bonkersness. But the Thunderdome itself, I could see it as iconic. It's like set up like one of those playground structures in a way, but it's all
yeah,
metal.
It's just a dome. It's like a
yeah, but there's like people are hanging from it because it's all set up and there's
yeah
there's it's basically Hunger Games style. There's weapons at the top and Mel Gibson and this weird fucking guy
Blaster.
Yeah, they're attached by
they're on bungee cords.
Wait, and to me that was just that's where the Vegas comes in because I'm like, oh my god, like the Hunger Games just got into Cirque du Soleil. So weird.
I think that's what captured so many people about this movie. It was just, all right, like gladiator style, we're gonna fight. But the second they put them on bungee cords and there's a chainsaw hanging from the ceiling and spears, but you gotta like bounce up to them and all this random weaponry and all the spectators can climb up the side of the dome and just scream through it. It just took on this intensity. They're doing air ballet to try to kill each other. Like it's amazing looking. The stunts there are phenomenal.
I'll give you that. The stunts are phenomenal, but it's just so fucking weird. I mean,
yeah,
this whole scene messed with my senses too, because there is a ballet quality to how they're fighting and being gladiators, but it's so fucking weird. It's so weird, listeners. Yeah. It's like there's chainsaws with Cirque du Soleil ballet. What the fuck? It's just blew my little brain. I just couldn't even like take it all in. And part of it didn't make sense to me because it's like then that there's an MC.
And like he's got his like showgirls behind him and they're giving the hype speeches. I mean, it's nuts.
But the hype speeches is he's like, you know, look at us now. And then says a bunch of words. I didn't even write down the words. It was just he gives a speech that's supposed to be some sort of pivotal, like as if this is some pivotal moment. And I'm like, what are you fucking saying? What?
I feel like they do this in Bartertown every Saturday night, though. Like, I feel like that same speech, those two girls, the chainsaws hanging from the ceiling, that this is just, like, regular entertainment for them. I don't know.
There are so many questions for me. It's a good scene, and obviously Mel Gibson, or Max, wins. Sort of wins. Yeah. And I didn't even understand that whole, explain it to me, Amanda. I just don't fucking get it.
All right. Well, and like, here's the thing too. Like, I think you feeling disoriented by all of this is the point. I think part of this film series.
A lot of credit.
No. But like, I think Max keeps landing in these societies that have set themselves up in a certain way and made up all sorts of weird shit. He's just trying to roll with it. But at the same time, it's just like, what the hell? Bungee cords and there's a chainsaw up there. And if I bounce really high, I can get the chainsaw. It's just like chaos, absolute chaos. And he's just trying to roll with it because I just want my damn car back. The stakes are really high for a very low reward for him. I'm watching Jess's face here because she's just like, what the F is with this movie? And like, I agree with you. I totally agree with you. Like, this is not supposed to make sense, but you're supposed to just feel like I've been thrown into chaos. I gotta get out of the chaos. Like, here we go. And so they're
fighting. I definitely felt that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, throughout the fight scene, the helmet gets removed.
Yeah. So it's revealed that Blaster... Max figures out earlier he's actually very sensitive to high-pitched noises, that Max has a whistle with him when he goes into the Thunderdome, and he knows the weakness of his opponent, so if he can just blow the whistle, the guy freaks out, knocks his helmet off, and realizes, oh, wait, this is somebody who's, like, intellectually disabled, and this is not morally right to be killing somebody. So he turns to Auntie and is like, nope, no deal, I'm not killing this guy, at which point... Tina Turner leaps into the Thunderdome. She looks so cool. Like, it's not, she's the bad guy in this movie, and I gotta call that out over and over again.
No, she does look cool. And this is the moment where I was like, oh, I just wish she would just start singing. This is where I wanted the concert.
I wish she would kick everyone's ass. She's not supposed to be the fighter, but if she just put a high heel through Max's chest or something, end a movie, but we'd all be happy.
I think I might have been happy. I'll just overall say that I understand why it's iconic. It is interesting looking, but there is just so much word salad. And I feel like seeing it for the first time as an adult, I was like, what the fuck is happening? It's not just the chaos. I still didn't get, like, am I supposed to be rooting for Mad Max? He's fighting for his car, but that feels just so low stakes.
Yeah.
That piece just didn't come together for me. And then when, you know, Tina Turner's getting mad at him and she's amazing and she's like flies into the Thunderdome, which is cool. Totally cool.
It looks cool.
It does look cool. I totally get it. It was honestly hard for me to root for Mad Max in a way, because I'm like, I just don't know if I care. The stakes generally for the apocalypse feel high. I still was just like, oh my God, explain to me why he's Mad Max at this point. Because, like,
yeah, but he doesn't seem that mad at this point. He's a little tame Max.
Yeah, a little bit. And I don't mean to get, like, over intellectual about it, but I just But I had a hard time connecting with him because I just didn't. I was like, I don't fucking get it.
No, that's totally what the character, like, after that first movie, and, like, honest to God, the first movie is really hard to watch. I don't recommend anyone go back to it, even though it's rated, like, 97% or some bullshit on Rotten Tomatoes. Like,
oh my God, the second movie is also really hard to watch, and I had a hard time getting
Like, he's an okay at best guy, but, like, he hits the point where he goes crazy because his wife and, oh God, they just keep killing all of his dogs in all of these movies. It's like John Wick but times three. It's the worst. And he, like, loses his mind. He wants to be alone in the outback. He keeps wandering into situations where he's like, ah, God damn it, all right, I'll save these stupid idiots.
But he at this
but point, like, that's a hard person to latch onto.
Yeah.
I totally get it.
He gets himself exiled, essentially.
Yeah, so he breaks the deal with Auntie. He refuses to kill Blaster, the big guy. So Tina Turner's assassins take him out. She jumps in the ring, and she's like, we're going to do the wheel. Because now Max is...
Oh, the wheel. I forgot about the wheel.
I mean, like, so kind of a better game of Wheel of Fortune than actual Wheel of Fortune. You got to wait there. They spin the wheel. Like, what's his punishment going to be? And it's the gulag, which... this is not the actual definition of a gulag.
I was like, so, a gulag, and then he's off on a horse. In the
we're night. Like, oh, they're sending him to Russia. No,
right,
no,
that's
not.
What I was thinking.
Bind him, they sit him backwards on a horse, and they put this weird mask on his head, and then just pat the horse, and off it goes into the desert.
And then the horse dies of thirst, which sort of
the
sucks,
horse dies of thirst, and then immediately sinks into, I'm just going to keep calling it the Sarlacc pit. I know we're in the wrong movie trilogy here, but, like,
that's okay. It's same era, though, so
Sarlacc eats the horse, and Max escapes because he is a faithful pet monkey somebody sent after him, although he
which is also, like, from another trilogy of this era.
Yeah, like, he falls on the monkey repeatedly, and my husband kept going, like, he crushed the monkey to death. It was like,
it's very concerned.
We were waiting, and it was like, oh no, there's the monkey again. All right, the monkey's still in the
monkey's okay. Monkey's okay. All right, unlike in Indiana Jones, where it gets poisoned.
This is where the movie takes a really slow, not exciting turn. So Max, he's sent out into the desert. His horse sinks into a Sarlacc pit, and he gets rescued by these creepy ass children.
Creepy. Like,
very blonde, they're very tan, they can barely speak English. Like,
I mean, that's the crux of it here.
Oh God.
What are, like, they saying, Amanda? I was thinking about this. In the apocalypse, do we just, like, lose our ability for language? Like, what's happening?
I mean, is this the equivalent of texting, but, like, apocalypse? Like, they're all speaking in, like, TLDR. Like,
LOL. Just standing there, like, what are they fucking saying?
The movie just slows to a crawl at this point because he's dealing with these chaotic children. I do not like this whole tangent.
I found it really hard to understand. And not just where the place was in the plot, there's nothing charming about it, and it could be charming because it's kids.
Some of the kids are genuinely cute, like the same way some of the, or the last boys from Hook are cute, but they're saying nonsense.
And this is where the grammar's all messed up, but then it makes it really hard to follow. I was noting that in Star Wars, when C-3PO is in the third movie, the Ewoks...
Talking to the Ewoks! That's exactly what this is! Right, they're but
the Ewoks worship C-3PO, and the Ewoks don't speak English. They're literally just grunting and have gestures. But I feel like they're
comparison.
Okay, but their grunts and gestures, I could understand it. And I understand what's going on. I understand the Ewoks more than whatever the fuck these kids are saying. I guess the purpose is that it's been far enough away from civilization that they don't really have like a basic understanding of things.
But, like,
but it's literally hard to understand them. And I don't understand. They think that Mel Gibson's character, Mad Max, is some sort of a long lost leader. That's why it reminded me of C-3PO. But it was so convoluted that I didn't follow it. I didn't find them charming. At some point, there's some sort of inter-kid battle. And I just didn't get it. Yeah. It was just so weird.
Now, this whole section sinks the movie. They're trying to build up this narrative of we have this tribe of children, but they're the descendants of this plane crash. But at the same time, it's like, where the F are the adults? Like, there are literal babies running around them. There's 18-year-olds and there's 3-year-olds. They're just like, oh yeah, no, all of the adults left. There's no explanation where the hell the adults went. They all left. Like, right, they just left their kids.
But I think that you're supposed to glean kind of that that's sort of the plot, that they were sort of abandoned, and that this is the ties into the whole apocalypse thing, and that they develop some sort of culture around the origin story of the plane crash. And I think that in another movie or in another setting, it could be interesting. I just wanted to note here that I did not watch this movie with my children.
That's,
I have to say,
good.
Probably a good move. For the parents out there, I just don't think it's going to work. But it wasn't because I thought it wasn't going to work. I was actually so naive that I actually was planning on watching it with them. It just didn't work out with our family plans. But I think that my kids like to connect with those other kids, and they understand things like the Skeksis in Dark Crystal. They totally get it, even though they're only saying things like, they totally get the Ewoks. So my kids, or just kids in general, I think could be okay with nonsense language in a way that bothers us as adults.
I feel like,
but there's no
kids,
way,
yeah,
no way that they would have related to this, because it just made no sense. It wasn't funny. There was nothing kid-like about them.
There's a girl who's like the storyteller of the whole group, but she's given way too much time to give this nonsense exposition that
total word
meaningless
salad.
Yeah, it just, like, nobody cares. They're going on about Captain Walker who flew the plane, blah 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 blah, and like, yeah, just a bunch of gibberish. It has no impact on the plot whatsoever. And it doesn't even honestly seem to have any impact on Max. He's just like, well, this is the best thing I've come across in all these random places I've wandered into in the outback. So he like doesn't want the kids to leave either. And when a few of them are like, oh, wait, you came from somewhere? We're going there. He flat out punches a girl in the face at one point.
Yeah, he ties up some girl. He's super aggressive with the kids. So again, there's nothing charming about it. And I'll say, I don't think kids today, this would land at all. Because it's just, who is this fucking guy in leather who's punching kids? What the fuck is happening?
He's not a people person. And he would, you'd call the Department of Children.
You need to be a people person in the apocalypse? I don't know.
And like, these kids are super annoying and not very relatable either. And here's the thing. Originally, this was the movie. It was supposed to be an apocalypse version of The Lost Boys, or an apocalypse version of an adult coming across a Lord of the Flies situation.
Oh, God.
And they turned it into a Mad Max movie. But originally, this was the movie.
There's no way this movie would have been a cult classic if they did what you described. I mean, you need
it
that
sucks.
Other stuff in there.
It so totally this, sucks.
I would venture to guess that any person, you know, Gen X, older millennial, who thinks fondly of this movie, they don't think fondly of this movie because of this middle bit. So then you were saying they basically decide that some of them want to go to Bartertown. So take us there.
So some of them, because their whole reason for being these kids is they think there is a better place, although they are living in a very like verdant, like there's a
Right, they're
river,
living in the...
there's gardens. They're in a very nice place for the apocalypse.
And I do think that this is the place in the Charlize Theron movie
she was trying to get to, maybe.
That she was trying to get to. So yeah. I assume that her character is supposed to be one of these kids.
Yeah. And meanwhile, these kids are like, no, like if we could just get back to Sydney in 1990
or whatever, or 2021 when it's like, been, yeah, like fucking radiated,
we want to go back to that civilization. And Mel Gibson's Mad Max keeps saying like that's not a thing anymore, like literally atomic bombs have dropped and it all blew up, that's not a thing. But all right, so half of them decide, since he came from Bartertown, they're gonna go there, which is the dumbest idea ever.
Dumbest idea ever. Stay,
he
stay in
is
your
very
waterfall
violent area. In his
don't go chasing
of
waterfalls.
Yeah, he's very violent in his enforcing of don't go chasing waterfalls. He punches the girl in the face. He like ties up kids and gags them. While he falls asleep, they all manage to escape anyway, and they're off. They're just bolting across the outback in peak heat.
These days during apocalypse.
So Max wakes up and is like, oh, they left. So he's gonna do the right thing and try to go wrangle them. He brings some tiny kids with him with their tiny spears. It's supposed to be cute and shit, but like it's not. These kids are useless. Like
useless. And what's weird about it is that I was sort of like, why is he trying to go after the girl that he punched in the face? Like,
yeah.
So there's real disjointed plot here. And it, again, me having not seen it, so I don't have this nostalgic attachment.
I'm
like,
with you. It's like, why wouldn't you just let her go? Like,
let
you
her
know
go.
What? You idiots. Go die. Go die on your way to Bartertown. They're going to just stick you in the Thunderdome anyway. It's going to be a hot mess. Like,
yeah, you're going to shovel some pig shit.
But, oh, Max, in his heart, he has to do the right thing. So he takes some tiny little helpers along.
Tiny little helpers. Oh,
they're
God.
Trekking across the outback. They find the kids halfway sucked into the Sarlacc pit. He pulls them out and then they're all like just sleeping in the middle of the desert, and they see the lights of Bartertown. So okay, we're going there. We have no plan, we have no purpose. Like, what the f are we doing? But
that, I mean, that's sort of a problem for me, because I was sort of like, what is the plan? They basically ambush or they attack Bartertown.
They don't, they sneak in through the pipes. All
right,
they do
right,
is like
they,
yeah,
but there's this intention of destroying it, and this is what I didn't understand, because it's this is where the plot was so disjointed, where, okay, they are going to Bartertown because they want to live there. But now that they're there, they almost seem that they're invading it and wanting to destroy it. So I was sort of confused as to what is the point? Like, what the fuck is the plan?
Yeah, they see Master, who's the anaerobic digester engineer at this point, for some reason decided to rescue him, even though we were literally fighting him the last time we saw him.
That was another question I had, because I just didn't understand why they were on the Master's side.
Yeah.
But I guess they're on the Master's side against the auntie character who runs Bartertown. And
right.
So there's this whole thing where the kids basically with Mad Max want to destroy the town. And
none of this is being communicated out loud. And like, I literally, having seen this before, and I just literally wrote, what the fuck is going on?
I found slight amusement in this, because as a parent, if you've ever brought your own children plus other people's kids to a playground or something, the kids immediately disperse and go crazy and they run everywhere and you can't keep track of any of them.
Do you end up with a train and you're being chased by Tina Turner and like a...
Right? But I guess I found that kind of funny, is that Mad Max all of a sudden is in the position of he's the dad with all these other kids that aren't his own, and being like
damn it,
where is everybody? Like, who's, do you have a buddy? Does there a buddy?
What are you doing with the pigs? Get
What's
out
going on?
This whole scene, there's no plan, there's no goal. They just end up like just swinging around. They kick a few people into
fucking
the pig
chaos.
Shit. Like, there's one guy who pops out of it and spitting pig shit out of his mouth. I felt that viscerally. He didn't go to work today, signed up for that. Like, oh,
it's
man,
God.
That guy. In a previous pop down to the underworld, Mad Max had befriended Pig Killer. He just said, I killed a pig because I was trying to feed my family. So Pig Killer's like, yeah, let's blow this place up.
And
passive aggressive
like,
employee there. So like, he's helping them out. He knows how to steal a train that'll lead out of there. And then suddenly we come bursting out of the underworld on this kind of truck train thing, but it's on a track. They're all hopping onto this thing. It's coming out of this cave-like situation where all the pigs are, and somehow blowing up everything behind it. So like, yeah, they're kind of
like utter chaos. There's explosions. There's a car chase. This is where the big car chase comes in.
It's a train car plane chase that happens after they come busting out of Bartertown. Like, it just goes so mayhem. It's awesome.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense, but it's awesome.
I guess it's visually awesome. And I guess this is part of the plot that I could actually follow.
Tina Turner there has gathered up all the people in their crazy homemade vehicles where things are just welded onto other things and everything looks crazy. There's a cow car. I don't know why. One of the cars looks like a cow, but it's a car. Big ass chase scene comes bursting out of this whole Mel Gibson with a bunch of kids in a tunnel full of pigs thing.
And this is again where the plot just like didn't fucking matter, because then Tina Turner, auntie, she's getting in these cars and it's like, well, why the fuck are they chasing them? Because they're leaving, right? So it's like this weird vengeance thing too. It's basically car chase for the sake of a car chase. And it's hard to understand the stakes why they give it.
She's trying to recapture Master, the guy who's like the engineer.
I didn't even get that.
They grabbed him, put him on the train, and they're blowing out of this joint. And she needs him because he knows how to run the anaerobic digester.
You just like fixed the movie for me in a way, because I was like, what the fuck is happening?
Yeah, no, all she wants is to get that guy back. She doesn't particularly care about Max at this point. She definitely doesn't care about these stupid kids. Like, she just wants the guy who knows how to keep the power on.
So in all this chaos and like plot, disjointed plot, I completely missed that.
Well, it's not clear because they're punching each other in the face. We're not supposed to ask questions. We're supposed to be like, wow, that's a badass looking car. Like, that's it. It turns into a gearhead movie immediately after they burst out of there.
But it's also a gearhead movie that still has that gay leather bar feel to it. What makes it so funny, because a lot of these Tina Turner's guards are wearing feathers in their hair. It's like a Thanksgiving parade gone so wrong.
I kind of want to see a version of that final chase scene set to Queen's I Want to Break Free.
Oh my God.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
I mean, part of me feels like there has to be some sort of gay leather bar, Thunderdome theme bar somewhere in the United States.
I bet there is. You and I are not invited to it as ladies, but like, it's probably amazing.
Sneak my gay ass into one of those places. But
yeah, if you find out about this, let me know. I'll go like.
Well, there's also a moment where like one of the very sweaty and feather-filled guards basically kisses Master. Both men, and I wrote down in my notes, I knew this movie was gay as hell.
There's a lot of guys out there who are like, I love this movie, and will never admit to that, but the gay vibe is strong in this movie.
But I think a lot of straight men love this movie, and I find that slightly funny. So,
because it's like this whole, it's so tough, it's the apocalypse, you gotta fight yourself to death, and they're tuning out the guys in the thongs who are sweating and muscly.
It's sort of like this macho fever dream, especially the chase scene here. It's all the macho things. It's welding, it's driving really fast, it's really good with weapons. Where does it cross over from macho fever dream to gay? I hope I don't get hate mail for this. I'm sorry.
No, it's spot on. It's
like in the apocalypse, all men become closeted gay men. And that's sort of that was my takeaway.
You know what? Like, if Tina Turner's allowed to dress all of her employees, she's just like, you know what? I'm wearing 120 pounds of chainmail, motherfuckers. You are going to wear some leather thongs and go down
see your butt cheeks.
Into the underworld. It's 120 degrees above ground. I'm going to stick you in the pit. Work it.
Yeah.
Work it.
So I generally, like, I liked the car chase scene. I thought it was good. Yeah. I feel like I've seen better. Even the one we saw in Raiders of the Lost Ark, I thought was better, actually, because it made just like more narrative sense. There's just not enough plot there to keep me. Whereas I feel like in the new one with Charlize Theron, there was enough plot there that I accepted the ridiculousness of the car chase. I see that it was cool. I see that it was iconic. But I'm like, I don't know who I'm rooting for. I'm kind of rooting for Tina Turner.
I mean, she's amazing bad guy. And like, we get to the end of all this and there's a reprisal of the guy with the airplane and his kid show up at the end.
Who, by the way, that guy with the airplane was in the second movie.
They float everyone up and fly them out, except they don't have enough space to clear the runway. So Max jumps it back into the vehicle and plows a line through so they can take off. And they ultimately fly to a devastated Sydney where everything must be super toxic because of the bombs. That's a boring way to end. But the awesome ending for Tina Turner is Max plows his car through their whole line. There's cars flipping over and he ends up jumping out of the car, so he survives the big ass crash. But Tina's standing over him with her goons at the end, and she makes a smarmy comment and like grins and winks at him and walks off and leaves him. And like,
but I don't understand, why did she leave him?
Because she doesn't care about him at all. It was just like, hey,
but she,
no, she doesn't get master. Master's in the plane. Master goes to Sydney with the kids.
So that's what I didn't get at the end. She's just sort of like, sexy wink, they like sexy wink at each other, and then that's it.
No, she's just flirty bad guy, like, we'll do this again. I don't know, I like that
ending. I wonder if
they're
setting it up for another sequel that never happened,
maybe. But yeah, I just like the idea that they didn't need to kill her at the end of this thing. She can exist out there and just go back and rebuild her dictatorship over Barter Town. And like,
I mean,
yeah, fine.
It's so funny because so now we're at the end of the movie, and part of me wrote down like, wait, how did this end? It obliterated my senses to the point where I just didn't even remember the end. I was like, who won? Who won? Did Tina Turner win? Did Mel Gibson win? I don't get it. Well, who won? Yeah. I really, again, think this is where if someone has nostalgia for this movie, they just, maybe I should ask you the question.
No, that's all right. So the ending is he sacrifices.
Yeah, you don't know.
No. He sacrifices himself to get everybody out of the situation. They go off to Sydney and they're living their boring lives out there. But like, when he's confronting Tina.
Terrible kids.
Yeah, no, he's just like, you stupid kids, get out of this movie. He and Tina have that moment. She, as this epic bad guy, is just, you know what? You're a good nemesis and that was a cool move. And you're not the one I'm here to like kill. So good day, sir. Kudos. That was nicely done. And just walks off and leaves him stranded in the desert. I like that as an ending where she's just like, wink, nod. Hey, good game, sir. Like, you know, handshake. Yeah. I will fight you in the future again.
Yeah.
That seems right for her.
I feel like there's somewhere in there, there's probably a good movie. Or just even her rise to power.
Yeah,
like that whole thing in the beginning, I was a nobody, I survived, and now I'm a somebody. Like that, there's a good movie in there somewhere. And
I would love a prequel,
wasn't
like
it.
Auntie. Yeah, like an auntie prequel.
I would see Auntie. I don't even care who they cast. I mean, I don't know if you could possibly replace her, but that I could get behind. I don't know. My 42-year-old brain was like in fucking pieces by the end of this movie. And I was just, I couldn't put it back together. I couldn't. And I spent days trying to, I watched it about a week ago, and I've been trying to like just piece it together in my mind. A mutual friend of ours from college, I saw, and their husband was so excited that we were going to do this movie, and
nice,
he wanted to watch
nice.
It. And he was like, oh, this is great. He's like, this is so good. It's so such an iconic movie. All of them are so great. So I was like, kind of like, okay, I'm into it. Like my brain still, even talking to you, it's like leaking out of my ear. I'm on my second beer.
I am simultaneously like, Amanda. I'm a little bit sorry, but mostly psyched that this broke your brain.
It like, broke my brain. It's,
I'm sorry, but really happy about
totally
that.
Totally broken. I'm still broken by it. We were saying at the beginning of this podcast that, you know, we're recording this right after we had this plume of smoke over your city of Boston and our city of DC. And it just puts you in the apocalypse mood. There is still a resonance to, I don't think it's going to take, we just went through a pandemic. It does not take much for society to break down to fucking nothing.
No,
to me, it's not just where society breaks down. It's like, where do you go from society to assless leather chaps? Because that's where, for some reason,
that's the one piece we're all missing. No, there were moments during the pandemic
Did Jeremy, your husband, put on his assless chaps and he's like, I'm ready for the Thunderdome?
No, he was ready to fight the guys in the assless chaps. Like, we were doomsday prepping. It used to be zombie prepping, but now it's assless chaps prepping.
Yeah, I think that my headline is that I need more leather for the next pandemic, obviously.
That's the lesson we're learning here.
Oh, God. So this was the movie and it broke my brain, but you have some fun trivia for us.
So this is all a George Miller production. He did all of the Mad Max movies, including the most recent one that we keep referencing with Charlize Theron. But he also did all of the Babe and the Happy Feet movies. So like he goes from this apocalyptic murder rapey to like a talking pig who gets along with sheep. It's so pleasant and adorable. That's the weirdest career track I've heard of any director. So like, good for him. Other cool things about this movie, you know that I love my special effects. All of the sandstorms in this are real.
That was crazy to me. They're all real.
So you and I both lived in Australia, but I was further out there than you were. Have you ever been in an Australian sandstorm?
No. I mean, I've been
excruciating.
I've been to like the middle part of Australia, but not in this area. Yeah.
I had a day of work where we were outside during a sandstorm, and I just remember like I had a bandana over my mouth and nose because you could not breathe, and it was just getting like rocks in your eyes the whole time. I just appreciate the attention to detail that they're doing with practical effects. Like, again, this is 1985, they don't have computer generated anything. They're just really blowing up all that stuff. They're really rigging up all those cars. They had that final chase scene. They had to make Tina Turner a special car because she couldn't do stick shift. I don't know. I nerd out on stuff like that, but it looked cool because it was real. Like, they really did those chases. That must have been so much fun.
Genuinely, what I appreciate about older movies from the 80s and 90s is that there's so much that could be accomplished by CGI, but when you do the CGI stuff in modern movies, it takes the danger away. It takes the stakes away.
Yeah.
I don't need it to look perfect. It looks more dangerous because it really is not CGI, and not just because you know there's people filming it, but it just has an element of real that you can't capture in CGI. So I think that is cool. I thought it was well done. There's real dust that's coming up from the tires. It definitely adds to an element of that is good. And this is the only positive thing I'm going to say about this movie for the most part. That and Tina Turner. So that I did appreciate.
Yeah.
In a way. So I have to give the production credit. I was pulled into this world. In some ways, I feel like I'm still in the world. I'm still thinking about it.
Oh, we need to get you out of there.
It's definitely
get on the plane, Jess, go to Sydney.
I know, I was definitely thinking about it for a while. It definitely pulled me in, and I have to give it credit for that kind of world building.
Yeah If you said, oh, I saw this Mad Max style car, like, you'd know exactly what they meant. It's its own look, it's its own world. It's super cool. It's such a gearhead thing. And Justin and I are not particularly gearheads, but like the way they're bringing up these cars.
No, I am not a gearhead. And I'll say that the other good thing I found about it, I don't really care about effects for the most part, the way that you like your face melting and all that shit.
Oh, but love it. Yeah.
I feel like I need more story. And there was one moment that I thought was really good where the chase scene is happening and the master pig shit master guy is with a bunch of kids and he finds a vinyl record player. And they're just playing like what sounds like a Hooked on Phonics French lesson. It's a good moment because you just sort of realize what was lost in the apocalypse. So clearly him as an adult is like understanding what this is. And the kids in the car have like no fucking idea what they're listening to. And there is a moment of sadness and, oh, we have to fight for something like civilization. This moment, I thought it was a good part of the movie, but it lasted like 30 seconds.
No, because it's going on in the middle of this huge chase scene,
but it was definitely
a poignant moment.
It was a coherent moment, and I feel like I wanted the whole movie to feel more like that.
We're focusing on the good.
That's all I got for the good. That's it.
Oh dear. All right. Obviously Tina Turner is, I just love the fact that some movie director came to her and was like, hey, making this post-apocalyptic movie, and you would be the bad guy, and you're going to be wearing this extremely heavy chainmail dress and have this completely crazy wig full of hairspray, and you're going to be overlord of this gritty, horrible town. Are you in? And Tina Turner's like, hell yes. And I want to sing the opening song and I want to sing the end credits. She leaned in so hard on the crazy, and I love it. Like, I love this about her. So,
yeah.
Tina Turner absolutely showed up.
Rest in peace, Tina Turner.
Rest in peace. For me, the fight sequences, like everything going on in Thunderdome is just like bonkers, bananas, but that's such cool choreography. You're very in the Thunderdome. So like that totally works for me. And then likewise at the end there, the train, plane, car chases, like everything they're doing there, the stunts, the explosions coming out of that. It just looks super cool.
Yes, I totally agree with you that stuff was cool.
Yeah.
But it wasn't as cool because I didn't have all these other elements of the story. I just didn't care. So
I think the story is totally lacking. I agree with you on that.
One thing I was thinking about is that it definitely pulled me in. This was a world. It pulled me in. That was good. But it felt like it was all scene setting. So it was almost like too much world building and not enough story. Yeah. And I feel like that's not even a product of the era of this movie making, because during this era, so this was made in the mid-80s, there's other world building that was done at this time. I mean, you had Total Recall, you had Blade Runner, you had Terminator. These are other examples of world building or apocalypse worlds together that this didn't have. It just had car chases. So I think that's where it ultimately, I felt like, fell down for me a bit. And again, I didn't have the nostalgia to carry me through.
Yeah.
It wasn't, I'm going to clutch my pearls cringy kind of thing, but it was more just, I'm going to scratch my head and be like, what? Yeah. Maybe this is why it broke my brain. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Closing thoughts, Amanda. Try to convince me that it lives up.
Oh, I don't think I can, but I did enjoy revisiting this movie. Like, this did take me back at least to high school, if not before that. I forgot how the grittiness of it made me feel a certain way that I'd forgotten about, like that this is really dark and really heavy. And I do think this has stuck in my brain in terms of what is the worst thing that could happen if society breaks down and if there's an apocalypse, if climate change takes us all, like, keep fighting the good fight, people, because we do not want to end up like this movie. So whether you like the cars or not, like, this is our worst case scenario.
Yeah, I feel like it is sort of a cautionary tale. Like, oh my God, guys, this would be a great message. If you're into environmental activism for whatever reason, do you want to go to Bartertown? I don't think you want to go to Bartertown. So we got to fix this shit. Like, could this be like a, oh, what do I need to do? I don't want to go to Bartertown.
Could this be a scared straight video for like ExxonMobil executives?
It's sort of like, this is your brain on drugs kind of like thing for me. Like, this is your life on apocalypse is Bartertown. Holy shit.
Ooh, bad.
Yeah. So I'd say my closing thought is that it's sort of like, you know, when you have a dream, like a bad dream or an intense dream, it's really intense in your mind. It's disjointed, but it feels really important and everything feels very articulate. And you wake up and those 5 seconds that you wake up, you think, this was really important and I need to tell someone about it. And then the moment you try to describe it, it melts out of your brain and makes no sense. And that's how I felt this movie was. There was something like, oh, okay, it was crazy. My brain is crazy. It's something really important. And then my brain melted. And that's the movie. It's just,
I totally get what you're saying. And I'm sorry, because you're watching me like laugh at you trying to describe.
No, but I think that's what's like, that's what's like, that's how dramatic. I felt this movie was.
It and feels intense.
Yeah, yeah, and I want, it's like, I really want to be in this world. I want to go back to sleep in the dream. But once you wake up, you don't fucking get it. Yeah, it's, oh yeah. God. So that's my closing thought.
No, that actually makes, that's very coherent for me.
Like, I mean, yes. I feel like I felt coherent thinking that thought. And right. Now that we're at the end of the podcast, I finally have a coherent thought about this movie.
Let's rate this movie then.
All right, let's rate this movie.
We're being coherent.
All right, so everybody, it's 1 to 10. 1 is garbage. 10 is Princess Bride. We do 2 different ratings. We'll start with adults, which is, did it live up to us as adults? Would you like to go first, Amanda? Did it live up to you? You're the one that has a nostalgic attachment.
All right. On a scale of 1 to 10 for adults, I'm giving this a 6. It makes me feel something. It's not something good. It's slightly on the positive side in that it takes me out of our actual existence and forecasts, like, this is a bad place that you all do not want to end up in.
So yeah. 6. And this is where I find interesting about the exercise of our podcast, that I do think nostalgia plays such a huge role.
It does. It does.
My score is going to go lower. I know. I bet. And I got to go as low as a 2. I'm going to give it 1 point for Tina Turner. And I'm going to give it 1 point for the costumes just being kind of fun. And otherwise, I just had a hard time with this one. So unfortunately, I think this is my lowest yet.
You went lower than you went with Rudolph.
I'm giving it a 2 because, oh God.
No, I felt this coming from you.
Yeah, I realize we keep torpedoing each other's movies that we love, but that's
what I don't consider this one mine, by the way. I'm not taking this personally.
So the next score is, does it live up to kids today, or at least its intended audience, which I would think is at least teenager, given.
Yeah, the so this is PG-13. So this, we cannot be considering this for 5-year-olds. You should not be showing this to a 5-year-old.
Oh ever. Yeah, guys, the parents out there, this is not the one to show your kids.
Yeah. So even as the fun movie in the Mad Max trilogy, this is not for children.
Not for, yes. Yeah. The fun one involving chainsaws and shit. Yeah. So 1 to 10. 1 being garbage, 10 Princess Bride. Give me your teen and above rating, Amanda.
I think for teenagers, I would go a 4. I think the action is exciting, but I think you're right. Like, the plot isn't totally comprehensible. And I think that the action bookending it doesn't make up for the fact that the middle of this movie just really sucks. I think it's a 4. I think kids would get bored.
Yeah, I was going to give it a 1, but I'm going to give it a 2. Hey. Again, I feel like I need to give, so 2 for adults for me, 2 for kids. Again, yeah. A point for Tina Turner, and I'm giving it another point for just, it's almost a period piece. And I do think there's maybe something with climate change that could resonate, but other than that, it's just not the best representation of this kind of movie. I dragged this rating down. I'm sure it's of the lowest.
You did. It's our lowest movie ever right now. Below Ferris Bueller, below Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Oh, sorry, Tina. The last thing is, we have to agree is whether we in this podcast deem this movie the Mad Max,
Beyond Thunderdome.
See, I can't even.
I think
my
Jess
brain is so broken.
Jess is so ready to move beyond the Thunderdome.
No, that's okay. But does it live up? And it's a yes or no. We both have to agree. And you know I'm a no. I'm a no. So I'm curious what you think, though. What is yours?
Knowing that you're going to give it a no to tank it, I'm actually going to give it a yes. Oh. Because, no, but here's why.
Here's why, yeah.
I'm hedging because I know you've sunk it already. This put me back into when I watched it as a teenager, and it made me feel the rawness of it and the chaos of it, and that just being able to bring me back, I think, like, for me, that was part of the purpose of this movie, was to put you in this place that's like uncomfortable and gritty. And so I think it did its job, and it lives up to the purpose that it was supposed to fulfill. It's bringing you to a place, and it's making you feel things. And that's what is living up for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a good point. I mean, I think it definitely made me feel things. And like I said, my brain is still broken. So yeah. It definitely had an effect on me. So respectfully, I still decline to say it lives up. I don't think it lives up. It's just, oh God, it's like, it's still on fire in my brain. And I'm glad that I've seen it though. So I'll give you that. Sorry to tank this. And, you know, for everybody else out there, and I think this one in particular, or the whole Mad Max series, has a certain resonance for people our age. And I think I'd be very curious whether people just think we're right on, or that my brain is so broken that I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. So please, listeners, let us know if you agree, if you disagree. We're at LiveUpPod on all the socials, or at LiveUpPod@gmail.com. Do you agree with us? Does this live up? What did we miss? Were we or I too harsh? Probably not. But I am curious about this one because I do think nostalgia plays a big role
Well, we thank you for listening.
The therapy session.
Hopefully our breakdown of this movie made more sense than the movie did.
All right, everybody.